You are now entering Video Village.
And to whoever's planting whoopee cushions in the municipal building, your days are numbered, shithead.
Coming up,
I review In the Lost Lands, Mid-Century Modern, and Season 3 of The White Lotus.
And then we review Common Side Effects,
Daddy Boys,
Reacher, Season 3,
Adolescence,
Novocaine,
The Electric State,
The Monkey,
and Snow White. Right, let's get mine out of the way.
Let's do it.
Okay, I'm starting with a film called In the Lost Lands.
Okay.
It's an epic, quote-unquote, fantasy set in a post-apocalyptic world, based on a George R.R. Martin short story. There's a witch, there's a bounty hunter, they gotta go do something.
Okay.
I can't remember what it is exactly.
Okay.
It starts with Dave Bautista, the bounty hunter, addressing camera. He says, if you've got the time and the stomach for it, here's a... Right?
Right.
There's the type of story this is. Firstly, don't insult me. And secondly, don't sell yourself tall.
Okay. Right?
If you can handle it. He goes on, this is not a fairy tale. There are no happy endings.
Right.
You know, okay. That bullshit before. With a wry little smile, he says it.
Is it... Blood Meridian is the name of the book I'm thinking of, right?
Yes.
The really gory. Does that, like...
Why are you bringing that up?
Well, I'm bringing it up because is that, like, oh, if you've got the stomach for it...
Yeah, that would be inaccurate.
No, but does it even do that?
Oh, no.
That's my point.
No.
A book that you actually need the stomach for.
Things that you need a stomach for really offer up a trigger warning.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that's part of the... Oh, my God. Like, if you're going in with that expectation.
Yeah.
It's directed by Paul W.S. Anderson, the evil Paul Anderson of the film.
Right.
If you're unfamiliar with his CV, he's behind the Resident Evils, all of them, I think, except the latest one. Alien vs. Predator, Pompeii, and Monster Hunter. He's just the worst.
Okay.
Well, one of the worst, anyway. As well as Bautista, this stars Mia, Miller, Jovovich, however that's pronounced, Anderson's most frequent collaborator, the De Niro to his Scorsese, but, you know, not. They're married, so that tracks.
Okay.
Layered upon the epic fantasy is Western imagery. Again, nothing new. The novels of Stephen King, for one thing. Here, really, it's Bautista wearing a cowboy hat. And there are horses. This, from Paul W.S. Anderson. Even his name is annoying.
Yeah.
At its heart, it's very much a Western, as it has all the iconography that one would associate with a Western. It's set in a post-apocalyptic land. So on the surface, it's not a Western. But at its heart, it's most definitely a Western. It deals with a lot of Western tropes and storytelling and imagery, so I'm very excited to be doing that. Okay. Articulately selling his art there.
It's a Western because it looks like a Western.
It talks like a Western.
But
incidentally, it's not a Western at heart.
Okay.
It is a Western on the surface. He said it. Imagery.
Yeah.
That surface, bud.
Yeah.
Like, imagery is literally the most superficial.
Yeah.
It's a boring, laughable, ugly mess. Top to bottom. The visual effects are diabolical. Nearly every backdrop is hideous green screen. It was filmed in Poland. A Polish studio, anyway.
Like, okay.
Nothing real here.
Right.
I'm not having a go. A Real Pain was filmed in Poland. But there are films made in Poland, and then there are films made in Poland.
Yeah.
This is the former.
Okay.
Or the latter. However you want to think about it.
Okay.
It has that artificial eyesore Resident Evil aesthetic, tailor-made for those compilation videos of the worst acting and writing ever. You know, like, and you shall be dead. It's that, right?
Okay.
The dialogue is piss poor on the page, further soured by stilted delivery. Here's one sample. The church, capital C, the villains of the church in this.
Right.
They kill Batista's occasional lover, and he screams all Batistically, "You say you're servants of God? What kind of God is this?" And then the villain responds, "The vengeful kind," with a flourish. Literally does a little swoosh as she says it.
Okay.
So, yeah. Another example, Bautista creeps up to a sleeping Jovovich, so it's like, you know, they're reluctant compatriots in this, and says, "A clever man might kill you, take your money, but no one ever accused me of being a clever man." Now,
right.
That has the rhythm of like a southern witticism, like, no one ever accused me of, but, so what, you're a dope? Like, I don't know what to...
A clever man would kill you right now, but I'm too stupid.
But I'm fucking stupid. Yeah. Bautista's really got to put his finger out at this point. Like,
okay.
He's just not... I keep holding out hope for him, and he keeps not living up to it.
No, I mean, like, The Rock is the fan favorite wrestler turned actor.
Sure.
And John Cena is, like, the fun one, I guess. He does a lot of the wackier, more out there
stuff. More comedy.
Yeah. Inclined. My understanding was in that little pantheon that's forming, Batista was, like, the proper one, quote-unquote. He's actually, like, a proper actor, you know?
I don't know how... I think Dwayne Johnson is the best actor. I just don't think he's done very good films.
Mm.
But I think he's the best actor of all of them.
Okay. Well, we'll be putting that theory to the test later this year, right?
Is it yes, this year the film's with the Safdie film. Yeah. Batista was good in Blade Runner, but that's the only thing I've really seen that showed potential. Otherwise, I find him quite stilted. Like, he's okay in Glass Onion. He's decent in that.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, his face... And, like, when he screams, like in Dune, I find him a little bit, it's like he's had work done.
Yeah.
You know, wrestlers, when they get older, there's like that tightening
of
this.
Yes, he's got a stiff face.
Yeah, there's a stiffness to it. Maybe the George R.R. Martin story on which this is based is good. By definition, it would have to be better. But this is impossible to take seriously. It's dopey fantasy with no sense of its own ridiculousness. If they played into the campiness more, that would have been something. I'd say this has all the hallmarks for straight-to-DVD film, but that would be an insult to straight-to-DVD films.
Okay.
Lock it in, lock it up, one of the year's worst, hands down.
Oh, shit, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll see where it stands at the end, but yeah, so far, absolutely.
Well, you're making it sound fun bad. Is it fun bad?
No, I don't know. Okay. I didn't have fun watching it,
okay.
But I watched it on my own. Maybe.
Okay.
You should give it a go. Next up, Mid-Century Modern. Do you know about this?
I don't know.
It's a multi-cam sitcom about three aging queens that decide to live together in Palm Springs.
Okay.
Stars Nathan Lane, Matt Bomer, and Nathan Lee Graham, who you probably know by sight, if not by name. Nathan Lane gets the most laughs. He's just unavoidably funny as like an object.
Yeah.
As you might imagine, it's rich with sarcasm and sass. And he excels at both those things.
Yeah. Well, he's funny not just as an object, because like he voiced the cat in Stuart Little.
He's also in The Lion King, isn't he?
And he's in The Lion King. Yeah. And in both of those, I think he puts in like funny performances.
Yeah.
And that's without his physicality.
Yeah, he has a funny voice as well, doesn't he? Matt Bomer is fine, even if it feels like quite a strange thing for him to be doing at this point in his career. Nathan Lee Graham can be pretty annoying, but not ruinously so. It's pretty much all gay jokes.
Okay.
That's the show. But they're mostly gay jokes from a former age. That age being the 90s and the noughties.
Okay.
It's oddly refreshing. So the writers for this worked on Will and Grace.
So they
have homo pedigree.
Yeah.
And homo pedigree from a less sensitive time. Considering the hit or miss nature of the multicam sitcom, this is sharply written and leans much more toward the former hit. It's directed by James Burrows, one of the traditional sitcom directors. His main credits being Taxi, Cheers, Frasier, and Friends.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that speaks to the fact this is an old-fashioned throwback in many ways. But it's not a family sitcom. The line that takes us into the opening credits of the pilot is, "You just look like a reluctant bottom."
Okay.
Ketamine's mentioned. We see a post-coital scene between Nathan Lane and some dude. We've seen those scenes between straight couples in family shows, but on top of everything else, it seemed too risque and insistent. But then in the second episode, the F-bomb is dropped twice in quick succession.
Okay.
Which was jarring, but at least recontextualized it as definitely not for the whole family, which is also jarring given the format, a multicam format.
Yeah, were there ever many of those? Kind of
no.
Like adult?
No, it's not a thing. It's basically not a thing.
Okay.
Like Louis C.K. did Lucky Louie on HBO, but they're basically not things.
Okay.
There's even a C-bomb, but it makes it easier to swallow, pun intended, when you think of it as adult, you know? Much of the time, otherwise, it's tonally family-ish in its delivery and cadence and emotional beats. So there are moments of, oh, from the audience, you know, and applauding dance numbers. There's quite a few dance numbers.
Oh, dear.
It's an unfamiliar mix, but you settle into it. It features a litany of guest stars, including Jesse Tyler Ferguson, Pamela Adlon, Billy Lord, Rhea Pillman, Judd Hirsch, and Richard Kind. Now, Richard Kind plays an old queen that's in love with Nathan Lane. And it's not reciprocated. He's a joke to the main character.
Right.
So basically, he's the guy you end up with at the end of the night when all the good men are taken.
Okay.
Right? Well, you could do a lot worse than Richard Kind.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say.
Yeah.
Fuck you. In spite of myself and everything it had going against it going in, I did kind of like it.
Okay.
Maybe it's because I'm, you know, not watching any other multicam sitcoms for they're all terrible.
Mm.
Maybe it's because sometimes you just want something simple. But yeah, if it's renewed, I'll be going back to it.
Right. Okay.
So kind of a recommendation.
Okay. Well, okay.
Okay. The White Lotus Season 3.
Now, I watched the first episode of this.
Yes.
And I sort of reached the end of the episode realizing that I hadn't really been paying attention to it. So I haven't gone back yet, but I also haven't written it off yet.
Well, see what you think after this review. We haven't spoken about it before on the podcast.
No.
But I am acquainted. I've seen all the seasons. Mike White is a very good writer. So Chuck and Buck was his breakthrough. But for me, The Good Girl is his early apex. It's a very underseen film. And I recommend it. I'll take this opportunity to recommend it.
Okay.
He wrote on Freaks and Geeks, then The School of Rock, highly underappreciated screenplay.
Oh, yeah.
Then a bit of a lull. I quite like Brad's Status from 2017. Unfortunately, Mike White was also one of the credited writers of the Emoji Movie.
Oh,
now,
no.
Hardly his fault, one imagines, right? Because there's like five writers.
I was going to say, it's probably one of those films where,
like, it doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And his later scripts were for Migration and Despicable Me 4. So like, kind of films.
He's done a few of them, then. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, somewhat up and down, but I think when he has some creative control, he's reliable. I've never been fully present with the show, and now would be the time to be present. It's instantly gorgeous, not just the scenery, but the photography and the frescoes I like. The characters are sharply drawn, there's some fun dialogue. Thailand having a lot of old bald men known as LBHs, losers back home. That half stung.
Okay.
I've seen it on the, you know, Your Mum's House, Tom Segura, that podcast. There's actually a lane on social media of, to put it charitably, beta males advising others to go to Indochina or South America because your dollar goes the distance and you can just buy a girlfriend.
Oh, right.
That's the thing. It's filled with actors I love. Walton Goggins, Jason Isaacs, Amy Lou Wood, Carrie Coon, Christian Friedel, so Rudolph Hess from, or Huss from The Zone of Interest.
Okay.
He's in it as well. Patrick Schwarzenegger is loathsome in it, in the way he's meant to be. I like the idea of Goggins' character, so he's kind of seen as mysterious and enigmatic and aloof, but he's actually just emotionally hollow. There's nothing there, says, you know. He was the most interesting character by quite a distance, and the most likable was Amy Lou Wood, and they're a couple in it. Real cracks begin to show at the end of the premiere, Carrie Coon just letting out this squeal. One brother looking too long at his naked brother as he's about to masturbate.
Okay.
You know, kind of weird. It creates a feeling of mystery and portent, even as the drama stays internal much of the time. I can see it being boring for people. I suppose I was always just curious enough to remain interested in what was going on. Some episodes are lulls, others more interesting. Sam Rockwell shows up for this wacky monologue and then just kind of sticks around for a while.
Okay.
There's a lot of attractive women not wearing the most clothes. That's got to recommend it.
Yeah.
There's an incest storyline that seems to freak people out. Now, it didn't freak me out, but I'm an only child.
Okay.
I still recognize it's gross, but it seems to have turned some people away from the show completely.
Okay. But does it... I mean, obviously, don't feel free not to spoil
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
But how gratuitous is it?
Not gratuitous.
Not like necessarily in what they're showing, but in terms of like how they're handling it. I'm guess I'm referring to.
Well, I said that one brother looking at the other one, it suggests that he kind of fancies his brother.
Yeah.
And then they kind of have like a threesome, foursome, where it's not clear exactly what happened, but they probably did stuff together.
Okay.
That's you don't see it though. That's no. Like, they imply it.
Okay.
And they film around it, but it never, yeah. But I get why some people are just like, oh, look, I'm not going anywhere near that.
Yeah.
In the finale, there's a great sense of tension, there usually is, because every season starts knowing that someone gets killed, right? So it's, who's it going to be kind of thing.
Yeah.
In the end, it's the most obvious suspect and the most obvious victim. The ending's kind of rubbish, really, and has received quite a lot of backlash.
Okay.
The person you think it's going to be the whole season that's going to kill, it actually just ends up being them.
Right, okay.
And it's a cop-out because it's kind of a 180. They change and then there's a 180 at the last minute, so yeah, it's not a good ending. And it's having the cake and eating it kind of thing. And
what do you think it was the writer trying to outthink the audience?
Maybe, but yeah, I won't say who it is, just in case you watch it, but it was a relatively okay season of quite low-key television.
Okay.
Not the best season. Yeah, it's low-key, it's a low-key show, you know, it's about internal drama and all that kind of thing. And
okay.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so it doesn't sound like you recommend it to everyone, but
no.
Like, who, if anyone were to watch it, who would you say is like, who's it for, really?
I would recommend, everyone should give it a try. Because I don't think there's a demographic that I'd recommend to, like, oh, if you're into blah blah, try The White Lotus. It's not like, it's not ASMR-y, but because it's about people going away to these spas, you know. It is kind of relaxing TV in a way, despite all the shit that goes on.
Mm.
If you're into prestige TV, give it a go,
okay.
I suppose is what I would say. If you're into quality television, but I'm not saying this is the best that's out there. But you're only going to watch it if you're into TV.
Okay.
It's not much like, it's not, if you're a comedy fan or an action fan or you know, if you're a Walton Goggins fan, by all means, give it a watch.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so that's The White Lotus.
Okay.
Common side effects.
Yes.
We're on to the mutual reviews now.
We are indeed.
Do you want to explain what this is about?
I will give it a go. Mm. There's a gentleman, a mycologist.
Yep. Studies mushrooms.
Yes. Yeah. They clarify that in the show. But although it's pretty clear what he means in context, because the show is about this guy who finds this mushroom in Peru that can cure anything.
Yes.
It can even cure fatal wounds and diseases. Yeah. It can literally bring you back from the dead.
Yeah.
And there's a pharmaceutical company that have kind of destroyed the environment in Peru. Mm-hmm. So he confronts them at the very beginning of the show. And the guy that's on stage representing the company, his assistant, is a high school friend of his.
Yeah.
So she approaches him after the conference, disguises who she really is and what she actually does. He reveals the mushroom to her. So she kind of gets involved in helping him, trying to kind of basically recreate the conditions to grow more of it so they can bring it to the masses.
Yeah.
While secretly she has an agenda where she wants to give this to her boss, so the pharmaceutical company can produce it and she can get everything that she's ever wanted.
Right.
You find out there's also this sort of conspiratorial angle where the FBI are hunting down this guy. And they're kind of under the thumb of the ultimate head of that pharmaceutical
company.
The CEO. Because he doesn't want the mushroom to get out to the masses. And there's a nice little monologue later on in the season from him where he kind of explains his reasoning. And he does end up going back on that because not long after that, he gets diagnosed with this, like, cancer, I assume. So he wants the mushroom for himself.
Mm-hmm.
But I did like his monologue. I don't know whether you were the same.
I can't remember, to be honest.
Okay. Well, he's basically talking about, like, because the guy is, like, pitching it to him. He's like, think of the money we can make. Think of how we can market this. And he's like, yes, but what happens when the cartel get a hold of it?
Right.
What happens when other companies start trying to replicate it, get it wrong? Our product is devalued because nobody knows who to trust.
He
basically talks about the economics of it and how that will basically lead to global collapse.
Well, really, this shouldn't be a panacea. This shouldn't be a thing that completely cures everything.
Yeah.
That's actually bad. That's a bad thing.
And that's the thing, because that's something the show discusses. And it does feel like the show is genuinely giving that perspective its due.
Given, the devil's advocate.
Yeah. Considering that the main character is completely pro...
Yeah, and ambiguously hippie kind
of... This is a good thing. We're going to bring it to everyone. Everyone deserves to be cured of everything. Yeah, yeah. But it does feel... And that's one of the things that I did like about the show, is that every character, no matter how ridiculous they seem on the surface... Because, like, the guy that... Francis is the name of the assistant.
Mm-hmm.
The guy that she works for, Rick, I think his name is, he's kind of portrayed as a bit ridiculous because he can't look after himself.
Yeah.
He doesn't really know what he's talking about. He's complaining about how shit his life is while room service is being brought to him and stuff. But it does feel like even he gets... Like, the show is even giving him the respect of listening to what he has to say.
Yeah, well, he comes around, doesn't he?
Yeah.
To what she's saying.
Yeah.
It's different, isn't it?
It is. It's animated, we should probably say that.
Animated,
it's an Adult Swim show.
Yeah.
Kind of... In a similar vein to Primal, in the sense that it's a show that takes itself completely seriously.
Not completely, but seriously enough.
No, it can have a laugh.
Yeah.
But it's not. Yeah, it's not like ridiculing any of its characters. It's not belittling them. It's not playing them up for a laugh. It's kind of
there's no feeling the show is one big ironic.
No, absolutely.
Wink. No, it's trying to do a serious story, but like with jokes.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just different in style and content. It's kind of that. Cheap or like fuck you animation that usually I wouldn't respond to, that would be that ironic. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's got that art style, but I do think the animation is deceptively well done.
Absolutely. But it has that kind of, for someone who's not into animation, going like, oh, an adult animation looks like that, no thanks. I know the millennialness of that, you know.
Yeah,
and it does veer towards that and getting a bit internet-y, you know, but I quite liked it.
Mm.
It worked for me bizarrely. Like, it starts with a sprint and just keeps going, doesn't it?
Oh, the whole it thing. Fucking starts.
Yeah,
like, that setup where, you've got the pharmaceutical company explaining what they do and who they are, and then him... What's his fucking name?
I can't remember.
It's terrible. He's the one character whose name I don't remember. But he confronts them. Francis figures out who he is, and she confronts him after the show, and he explains what the mushroom is, and it kind of sets everything in motion.
Yeah.
I think that's like 5 minutes.
Yeah. Because they're like 20-minute episodes.
They're 20-minute episodes.
Shorter sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No, so it's really proper. Like it. You can tell that it knows exactly what story it wants to tell because it's doing it immediately,
instantly. Yeah. Now, Mike Judge doesn't write it, but he produces it and he provides a voice.
Okay.
I like Mike Judge.
Okay. A lot.
Do you know Mike Judge?
Not by name.
King of the Hill, he did. Beavis and Butthead, like those were his animated shows. The Silicon Valley, that's him.
Oh, okay.
He's a good writer. Now, Big Pharma is always a fertile subject, but it has special relevance of late because of Luigi Mangione, was that his name?
Oh, yes.
The Killed the Pharma bloke.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of all I got to say, really. It's just this little niche gem show over there. And I'm not an animation guy, but I did like it.
Yeah.
So I would definitely recommend it to people.
Yeah, and I think they have renewed it for a second season.
They have.
And it definitely leaves itself open for a second season.
Yeah.
In a way where I think they could leave it there, like in terms of where the show kind of ends, but it does invite, like you do want to know more. You want to know what happens next. So it's kind of nice that they're going to get to continue that story.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a well-told story. It's got a very like dry sense of humor, which was nice, because usually things like this, especially those kind of more abstract, trippy sequences, mm-hmm. when people take the drug, they kind of get transported to this realm.
Yeah.
Where there are these like little creatures there. And it's very like...
Yeah, like DMT mechanical.
Yeah. And you think like, oh, okay, it's another Adult Swim show where it's doing drug. But it's not that at all.
It's not that.
It goes beyond that. It feels like it does actually have something to say, and it is... It's interested enough in its characters that it's willing to listen to them. And that's one of the things that I liked about it, is that, everyone, even the more ridiculous characters, the show lets them speak.
Yeah, they get respect.
And lets you consider their perspective.
Yeah. Absolutely, okay. So we both recommend it.
We both recommend it.
Well, I hope you remember this when you accuse me of never liking animation in future.
Oh, one. We got one.
It's not one. Wallace and Gromit was my 10th best thing of last
year. That's Wallace and Gromit. That doesn't count.
Oh, don't count as it. Oh, no. Because it's the best thing. It doesn't count.
Yeah.
Give me a break. Okay. Daddy Boys.
Yes.
What's this one about?
This one is, there's two brothers.
Brothers, yes.
Brothers, Daddy Boys.
They don't speak like that.
No, they don't actually.
They look like they would.
Yeah. Indian, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it Indian, Pakistani? It's one of those two.
No, because I think Pakistanis come into it a little bit later. I think
Indians, yeah.
Yeah, I think they're of Indian descent.
Yeah.
There's two brothers. One of them is kind of, he's the clever one who's kind of a little bit nervous and a little neurotic and a little, you know.
Yeah.
And then you've got the other one who just like takes drugs.
Who isn't.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, we're all just chakra floating in the
typical
void.
Old couple.
Yeah.
Thing.
And their father, their Baba.
Baba.
He runs a deli chain.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, boys, I've just bought us a golf course and it's going to make us so much money because we're going to service the golf
take
course.
Take over the world. Yeah.
We're going to, everything's coming up, Baba, or whatever he says.
Okay.
And then he gets killed.
Yes.
A golf ball hits him in the head, he bleeds out, dies. And then they find out that the deli chain is actually a front for a drug kind of running operation.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI catch wind of this, they seize all of the assets, they close down all the delis, they take all of the boys' fortune that they've inherited away from them. But there's one deli left that was off the books. And they start working in that deli.
Mm-hmm.
And they start trying to build their father's operation. Initially, reluctantly, I think, but they kind of get into it.
They're supposed to just be the front, aren't they, initially?
Yeah.
And then they get more involved.
Get more involved.
It's comedy.
It is a comedy, funnily enough.
Yeah, well, you mix Breaking Bad with 6 Feet Under, dial down the quality by about 70%.
Okay.
And then filter it through mainstream American comedy. That's what this show is.
Okay.
There's also like those Guy Ritchie, Tarantino-style freeze frame character cards. You know, like Raj.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, so we have the Odd Couple brothers, David and Nate Fisher, basically, from 6 Feet Under.
Okay.
In the pilot, the father outright explains their characters. Like, you're patient and thorough, you have instincts, right? Okay, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Also, like 6 Feet, the death of the patriarch is the inciting incident of the show. The sons have to take over the business. They find out the father had a secret hangout. All that stuff. I don't particularly like either brother.
No.
But Raj is, of course, less bearable. The supporting cast makes it, really. Like, I like seeing Kevin Corrigan in things. He's the Italian-American mobster.
Yeah. Chicken lasagna or whatever they end up calling
him. Chicky, whatever it is. Yeah, Lozano. Yeah, Chicky Lozano. That's his name, right?
Yeah.
But they call him Chicken Lasagna.
But this is the thing. He's called Chicky Lozano. They call him Lasagna.
Yeah.
Initially as like a, what, is your name Lasagna?
Yeah,
it's one of those.
Yeah.
But then everyone just calls him Lasagna thereafter.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in the final episode, he reveals that Chicky is actually short for chicken.
Okay.
So he's actually called Chicken Lasagna.
Okay. It's bizarre but pleasant hearing Brian George using his real accent. He's a guy that you'll have seen on, like, American comedy. He plays Raj's father in The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Raj, what are you doing over the Skype, whatever. Yeah. But he just has a British accent.
Yeah, I didn't realise that that was his actual accent.
Neither did I.
Yeah.
I did not know he was a Brit. He was probably the standout for me, but Poorna Jagannathan is good too. There aren't, you know.
Yeah.
I can see nominations going her way.
Well, especially since she kind of has a backstory episode, doesn't she?
Yeah, yeah. And like female crime boss, it's kind of a an awardsy kind of role, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a juvenile fratty idea on one level, like two literal bros getting into scrapes. But it's better than most of those things.
Okay.
And I say that this is not a great little subgenre, but better than most of those things. It's an easy watch, an easy binge. I didn't find it funny.
No.
Really. Like the sycophant screaming at the father's death and the FBI, I found that a bit funny. There's quite a lot of men screaming in this, actually. It's that type of American comedy. When someone's killed and they just scream.
Yeah.
And
I suppose I did like that. Yeah, you've got the kind of the female FBI agent who's really like, she's the first one to clock that, like, hang on, there's something else going on.
Yeah, yeah. She's like the straight character.
When she takes that information to her boss, who's guy that he's had, like, he's got a book deal because he did some sort of big undercover operation before.
Yeah, yeah.
He busted a huge, cracked a whole case wide open, wrote a book about it. He's like kind of a little celebrity. When she brings all of this to his attention, the typical thing is that he'll kind of go, oh, well, you know, I know what I'm talking about and there's nothing here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But no, he believes it from the start. And towards the end, they do kind of frame it as like, oh, he's just looking for his next book deal. Mm-hmm. So he's just there so that he can take credit as soon as they kind of crack the case. But I do kind of like that. No,
it wasn't the typical.
Yeah, thing, no, he does actually believe her. And he is there in the field with her trying to, like, figure things out.
It's
okay, that's more than what I was expecting.
Yes.
From something like this.
Yeah. But yeah, I didn't find it funny.
No.
And I wasn't really interested in the story either.
Well, I think that was kind of the problem for me, is that, yeah, you've got this very silly mainstream American comedy tone, and occasionally they try to inject pathos into it and actually make you care about the characters and the dynamics and kind of... But these two tones are kind of like trying... They're fighting each other because they're being forced into the same space and they don't mix very well.
Mm.
Or it takes a very good writer to make them mix very well.
Yeah.
And they just don't. So... I didn't find the comedy funny.
Yeah.
And then when I was being asked to care about the characters, it was like, well, you just wanted me to laugh at them a moment ago, so...
We can do both, but...
You
don't here.
It doesn't do it well. So it's like, I don't try and make me care after you tried to make me laugh.
Yeah, and I didn't. I didn't care about, like, it's fading from memory in real time kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been renewed yet, but if it is, I probably won't go back.
No.
I feel like I get it, you know? So, unless it reinvents the wheel in the second season, you know, but... It's not going to do that.
No.
So I don't think I'd recommend it.
I don't think I would, but I think a lot of people have watched this already.
Yeah. It's not a bad show. It's not bad, I don't think.
I can certainly see how someone could enjoy it.
Yes.
But it's also one of those shows where I would kind of like someone who does enjoy it to explain it to me.
Yeah, agreed. Reacher season 3.
Okay.
It just starts.
It certainly does.
Season, like common side effects.
Yeah.
It just starts with a sprint.
I think we've brought up Reacher briefly.
Very briefly.
We've never given it a proper time in the spotlight.
We're going to do that now.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we both watched the other two seasons.
Yeah.
And we've kind of grouped it together with The Diplomat, haven't we?
And another show, The Night Agent.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, where it's just like really competent...
Entertainment.
Yeah. It's kind of lowest common denominator, but like slightly elevated in its quality.
Yeah. Lowest common denominator in a way, just everyone can enjoy it. Not like pandering.
Yeah.
And not like fart jokes and stuff.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, it was just competent TV that we recognize the quality.
Yeah. Like, we'll keep watching it for as long as it goes on, but it's never going to be on the greatest, any greatest lists, you know? Okay, so yeah, it just starts. Now, I didn't believe the scenario was genuine at all.
Okay.
That starts the season off. His behaviour was off to me. He was nervous. Like, no.
Okay.
I thought it was just like a cool, cold open set piece to drop us into the season. That the kid would like reveal some information then Rachel would pull over and be like, oh, we got what we needed, you know, that sort of thing. And the kid would get arrested. It had that energy, but no, it just kept going. Luckily, it was only 20 minutes before they clued us in as to what was really going on.
And then I think the rest of the first episode is kind of rolling back a little
bit. Yes, and explaining how we got there.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Alan Richson, Richard, just does the job.
It's sort of reached the point now where...
Richard.
His performance isn't... Again, it's not like one of the best of all time. Mm-hmm. It's not up there with like Bryan Cranston or anything like that in well, anything he's in, really. but... It's reached the point now where I can't imagine another person playing Jack Reacher.
No, absolutely.
He really has become that character for me.
It's lived in now.
Yeah.
It's effortless for him. Yeah. You know? That's what it looks like anyway.
And there's enough, like you kind of alluded to it there, he's clearly doing enough where you can recognize when he's out of character.
Yes. Yeah, he's a good actor.
Yeah.
Despite being like this massive... Could we look at those guys and we think, you know, that means you're probably a shit actor. You've been hired for your physique.
Yes.
Like Stallone... Schwarzenegger, like not the greatest actors in the world.
Yeah.
But we have a new generation now that are kind of doing both. Steroids for one thing.
Yeah.
But like Hemsworth, decent actor, you know. Pratt, he can be a decent actor. This, the guy from Rebel Ridge, can't remember his name off the top of my head, but you know, like,
oh, yeah.
Action heroes that can act.
Yeah.
Yeah, he continues to make it ludicrous that Tom Cruise played the same character.
Yes.
That's just fucking bonkers.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the first episode where he got to check something out at like 3 a.m. So he has to wait for everyone to fall asleep. It just cuts to that time, him just sitting on the side of the bed, implying he's been still for hours and hours.
This is one of the things that I've come to really love about, because the show is, it's such an understated show.
Yeah.
Like the title card of the show is literally just white font on a black background.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even have a theme song. The title just comes in and goes, boom.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And it's silent credits. And even the posters for this show. It like season
this
one.
Is low key. Yeah.
No, it's season one. It's like behind Reacher, but he's looking over his right shoulder.
Yeah, like he's looking over his shoulder toward the camera kind of thing.
Yeah. And then season two, it's the same thing, but he's looking over his left shoulder.
The other side.
And then season three, now the camera's in front of him, but he's still looking
over
his shoulder.
He's still to the side. Yeah.
So it's like, it's kind of, no nonsense.
No faff.
No faff, no flair, but it's just like doing the thing.
It's just doing the thing. And just that for me was the character in a nutshell. Just like, oh, I just have to wait.
So he just sits there. But that's the thing, because they've always kind of framed Reacher as, like, he is uber competent.
Yes.
He knows everything he needs to know in that moment. He can, like, look at a person and be like, oh, this person is... They used to be in the army 25 years ago, and they have a chip on their right finger, and they have this...
Yeah, not quite in the Sherlock way, but just, like, he assesses threat very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it seems like in this season, they've started to play it up for laughs.
Yes.
But in a way that doesn't undermine that character at all.
Not at all.
No.
Here's the thing. I do find him cool.
Yeah.
And that's not a common feeling for me.
Yeah.
I don't often find things cool. There's also a scene where the villains make him play Russian roulette. And to prove himself, he pulls the trigger more than they ask him to, you know.
Yeah.
When he's later talking to his contact... he explains that he had the chamber marked so he knew where the bullet was. And if it had come up, he'd have used it to kill a guy behind him, tackle a guy in front, whatever. It's not mindless, brazen, consequenceless bravado that you get with an old Schwarzenegger or every Steven Seagal film.
Yeah.
He's macho and impressive while also being calculated.
Yes.
You know? And if he didn't climb down a building, it certainly looks like he did.
Yeah.
He just climbs down it.
Yeah.
It's the right kind of flex, you know, not an elaborate single take. Just watching a guy do something.
Yeah.
Which is impressive. And now Alan Richson and his family sold their house in 2023, and they live on the road, like living out of hotels and Airbnbs.
Oh, so he's actually...
He just is Reacher.
He just is Reacher.
He's obviously the guy for the job.
Wow.
Yeah. It retains the effortless crack-on energy of the former seasons. And again, I was more present for this one, ready to be entertained, and I was.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot more than before, and I have the podcast to thank for that I paid attention to it, and you know.
Yeah.
While it can be an ask sometimes for this podcast, one is no longer able to watch something unopened and unengaged, you know? No more thoughtless, monotonous binging. It makes you appreciate things. Mm. Now, there are times like, oh God, I've got to pay attention to this crap now.
Yeah.
But... then sometimes you get things like this.
Absolutely.
The sense of humor, yes, was potent and plenty. I think I need to rewatch the first two seasons because, I can't remember them being like that.
No.
Him stalling by just standing and holding a pot of coffee without pouring.
Yeah, again, it's no elaborate, like, he's not putting on a show or anything. It's literally, you have to kill time. So he's just not doing anything.
He's just not doing
anything. He's stationary.
Yeah. And it feels like they're using his characterization for laughs, yeah, as well as everything else. But he's so rigid and unworried that it can be funny.
Yeah.
And then there's that line when they get ice cream and he's like, any flavor other than chocolate or vanilla is nonsense.
Okay, that...
I don't agree with it.
No, I don't agree with
it. But it's so on point.
Especially since, I think in that instance, the kid has given him like lavender infused. It's some like ridiculous flavor.
Yeah, it's some woke ice cream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like... No, that's not fair, Richard. You know, like if he'd given you mint chocolate, maybe you have something
both
else
like
to say.
Mint. Yeah, but because strawberry is floated, isn't it? The kid goes, "Well, what about strawberry?" And he goes, "Like in a pinch, like if nothing else is available,
yeah,
strawberry. Like strawberry is as elaborate and as like pretentious as he's going to go.
Yes.
Strawberry." And then there's him shooting the guy in episode 5. He's doing like the elaborate go over there movements, and he pops up. Her kissing him. The kid recognizing the dead cop and then trying to pull the kid out of the car and he's just locking it.
Yeah.
And he's just staring at him. Like laugh out loud stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I liked Sonya Cassidy, so that's the contact and the love interest of the season.
Yeah, I like just how regional her voice was.
A Brit doing not just an American accent, but a New England.
Yeah. One. Gives it like that little extra swirl of personality.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the man being objectified, like she watches him change and that kind of thing. It's like it is in Bridget Jones. You go, oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I mean, when he looks like that.
Well, that's because it's built that goodwill in you, you know? And it's funny here, too. Like, the chemistry between those two crackled. And what do you do for an intimidating Reacher villain? Well, Reacher big, he bigger.
He bigger. He much bigger.
He much bigger.
Yeah.
I don't think you could get much bigger than Reacher.
No, well, that's why it's so effective. And it's nice. Can you said earlier about, like, how unflappable he is.
Yeah.
And how the show is now, like, it's able to play with the fact that he's so unflappable. When that big guy, like, slaps him.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see how, like,
he's rattled.
Yeah.
Fuck, okay.
He's in pain. It does have an effect on you.
It does.
Because, again, such an understated, like, he's not screaming, he's not yelping. He's just, you can see in his eyes, he's like, oh, fuck, this guy is a challenge.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And the finale was actually exciting.
Yeah.
Again, rare. Like, a great gunfight. A great henchman brawl, epic in scale.
Yeah.
Like, you're waiting for that the whole season, and they don't skimp out on it. It lasts half the episode, that fight. It's all far-fetched, right? But that's fine. It's old-school action.
Yeah.
It ticks all the boxes it knows you want ticked. It plays out to optimize satisfaction. But it doesn't feel low common denominator in that way.
No.
You know, like, it just feels like entertainment. And I actually got a bit emotional at the end when Teresa goes home and I'd see him riding off on the motorbike. I was like, okay, I know I like it then. If I'm actually getting a little bit emotional.
Yeah.
One nitpick.
Okay.
For the season. A villain tells Teresa, she like hits him or whatever. He's like, I love a little fight in a woman. And then Sonya Cassidy appears and says, you're going to love me then. Now, maybe that line predates The Dark Knight, but that's the unavoidable connection.
I thought of The Dark Knight as well.
Now, I'm not saying women can't enjoy it, but it's a show for men, right? It is. It's a show, like, that would be on the, was it, Movies for Men channel back in the day. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. But then again, they've got Alan Richardson to look at.
Richardson,
sorry.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, I agree. He's the eye candy kind of thing.
Yeah.
But do you know what I mean? It feels like it's designed for, like, your dad kind of thing. There's no ambiguity or complicated exploration of revenge. You know, it's not unpacking vengeance. Reacher finds the bad thing from the past and kills it, all right? That's just what
he even
does.
Says.
That's like, what he says.
Yeah, that's what I do.
That's what I find the bad thing and I kill it.
Yeah.
There's not a hint of woke. It's a throwback. He's a throwback. I think Cassidy calls him that in the finale, right? The season transcended its diplomat, night agent, peers.
Yeah.
It deserves some awards recognition, I think. How, where, and why, I'm not exactly sure, but I'm just excited to see whatever they do next. Really fun season.
I'm curious, because there are Reacher books, aren't there?
Yeah, yeah,
and loads. This is based on one of those books.
Yeah, I think they're random.
Yeah, they are random. I would be curious to know if this is a good book as well, like one of the better books, or whether the show is just confident enough in what it's doing now that it's able to like do more with its source material.
I imagine it's pulpy, like enjoyable books, like airport books for, again, men, basically. I don't imagine they're good literature.
No.
I think they're just like entertaining novel, like the kind of thing I would have read when I was like 12, 13, something like that. A good gateway, really. Like you start off reading thrillers and then you'll kind of migrate into the, you know, the better stuff. But just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And very competently made. Again, that's what it shares with The Night Agent and The Diplomat. It's just like, you don't notice anything, you know?
No, absolutely.
Just put together perfectly.
Yeah. No, this is this. Yeah, this season has elevated the show to the point where I'm excited for it to come back.
Me
now.
Too.
And like you, I'm curious enough to go back to the first two seasons to yes. see, like, is this just that much better?
Yeah.
Or am I just finally
seeing it? Yeah.
And will those first two seasons be better upon a rewatch? Because I'm like, I'm in it now.
Well, there's a shower scene with Willa Fitzgerald, isn't there?
I'm more than happy to go back to that. Yeah.
So, yeah. And I didn't know her at the time when I saw that first season, you know? Okay. So, yes. Okay, we recommend Reacher.
Absolutely.
Adolescence.
Yes.
What's this one about?
Oh, okay. All right, you're giving them all to me, eh?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's your job.
All right, just being upfront about it. Adolescence is from the people behind Boiling Point.
Yes, minus one writer.
Minus one writer. Just kind of saying that up front because the main gimmick of the show, and I think a thing that... Before it came out, the thing I thought it would be sold on is it's a one-take
yeah.
show.
Every episode is one take.
Every episode yeah. is a single take, or at the very least, it's using techniques to make it look like it's yes. a single take. Because I think there are hidden cuts.
I don't know.
I'd be surprised if the third episode wasn't a genuine one take.
Yeah.
But there are some bits in the other episodes where yeah. they're probably stitching things together.
The things you've talked about, which I know you've been going through the window and everything, I've seen behind the scenes things where they show how they achieved that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm kind of willing... I'm not being cynical about it.
I'm willing to believe that it is genuinely one take, because I do think off the success of Boiling Point, they would be given the resources they needed to achieve genuine one
take. It was commissioned on that premise.
Yeah.
Stephen Graham, I think he said, Netflix wanted us to do a one take thing.
Okay.
They saw Boiling Point and wanted him and Barantini to do a one take show.
Yeah.
And then they found a story to go into that format.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'd be surprised if it wasn't that.
The only reason I'm kind of qualifying is because I don't know for certain.
Yes, yeah.
I would like it to be one take. I wouldn't be surprised if it was.
I'm willing to believe either, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, what it's about is Stephen Graham is the father of a child that is arrested for murdering a girl in school.
Yeah, 13-year-old boy, I think.
A 13-year-old boy killed a girl of a similar age in school. The first episode is his arrest.
Mm-hmm.
And him being taken into
processed
and everything like that, and then being confronted with the evidence, like CCTV evidence, that suggests that he did indeed do it, despite him...
Insisting otherwise.
The second episode is the detectives at the school interviewing his schoolmates.
Trying to piece together
like the
picture of his psychology and all that.
Picture of his psychology, the movements of the victim, everything like that. The third episode is... that boy who's been arrested and a child psychologist kind of at the end of their course together.
Yeah, yeah.
She's basically putting together like a pre-trial assessment of him.
Just trying to understand him. Yeah.
Trying to understand what drove him to do what he was doing while he's still kind of protesting his innocence.
Yes.
And the fourth episode is much later on. I think a year later, right?
Or, I think so.
Yeah, over a year later.
That. Yeah, yeah.
And it's on Stephen Graham's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of about the family living in the shadow of... the fact that their son has gone to jail for murder.
Yes.
Or that he's on trial to go to jail
for
murder. So yeah, every episode, it's just sort of like a vertical slice of the period of time after his arrest.
Obviously real time.
Real time.
Yeah, yeah.
Every single one, yeah.
Okay, so it's obviously technically impressive, right? And I'm not saying that's something at which one shouldn't marvel, but you have to get past it, right?
Okay.
Like, the show has to earn itself beyond that.
Right.
Because if you just remain in a state of awe at the cinematography, you'll miss things.
Yeah.
That's one thing. The flip side of that is that single takes are high wire acts, and I didn't want to be looking for the seams.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's unavoidable, but I didn't want to be looking for them.
Yeah.
So I went in taking it as a given that the presentation was going to be flawless, allowing me to concentrate on everything else. Even if I hadn't abided that philosophy, I still think I would have fallen into its rhythm, right? I did forget about the single take of the thing.
Mm.
Then it would bob back to the surface. And not because of anything the show was doing, necessarily, just because things reoccur to you, right? But the end of episode two certainly invites some applause.
Yes.
Right? Becomes this drone shot, and it's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first episode was my favourite. The professionalism of the police, you know, like the beat-by-beat process of processing, the familiar bureaucracy of it, British bureaucracy, too, was anxiety-inducing.
Yeah.
it's the tone of a doctor's office, you know?
Yeah.
Despite that unease, it's profoundly Moorish.
Yeah.
You get to the end of that hour, you're like, that was horrible, but I need to see what's next.
Yeah, I
want to
know what happens next. I do like the first episode. I particularly like the second episode.
I like that one too. Yeah.
Because it sort of becomes clear what the show is going to be doing. It's not going to be just... Like, because initially after the first episode, you're like, oh, is it going to be, like, are they all going to pick up, like, right after each other?
Yeah.
Is the whole thing going to be basically in real time? But the fact that it's jumping around and the fact that it's not necessarily focusing on the same characters every single time.
Yeah.
Because you've got characters that run through the whole show, but each episode kind of has a different protagonist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's like, oh, okay, they're actually showing what they consider to be the important beats. And what the second episode did for me is it kind of shows the devastation mm-hmm. that a single death can cause mm-hmm. in a community.
Right.
You've said a couple of times on this podcast that shows, television, film in general, mm-hmm. they're not giving murder its due.
Yes.
As of late.
Not treating it with the gravity.
You've got like fun shows like Only Murders in the Building.
Yeah,
it's like, well, no, death is still like
murder
is like a serious deal, you know?
Yes.
Like, yeah, you're not going to get a fun show about rape, but murder seems to be like, we've just kind of like made that fun now.
Right.
This doesn't make murder fun.
No.
It shows you, like, yeah, how far-reaching the misery and the grief...
It's one person dying.
One person dying, yeah.
Absolutely. Everyone's very, very real.
Yeah.
Featuring Shea Meadows alums, quite a lot of those from Mrs. England and Dead Man's Shoes. A lot of talented British performers. One of the producers here is Mark Herbert, also producer of the Meadows films. Co-writer Jack Thorne co-wrote the This Is England miniseries.
Okay.
As well as the Netflix film Joy from a few months ago.
Oh, yeah.
And the miniseries Toxic Town from a few weeks ago.
Okay.
It's this little community of collaborators. It goes without saying that Stephen Graham is great.
Yeah.
But the impressive standout for me was Ashley Walters. Like, to be fair, I haven't seen him in a lot, but I didn't know he was the kind of actor that could do something like this.
Ashley Walters is the...
The detective.
The main detective.
Yeah.
The previously collaborated with Noel Clarke.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the only thing I knew about him, is that he previously collaborated.
Same, pretty much.
Yeah.
What's that show he did? Boy, right? Like a urban black inner city.
Is that the thing he did with Noel Clarke?
Well, they did, like, I think they did Brotherhood and Anotherhood and all that stuff. Is it Anotherhood? Kidulthood and Adulthood.
Okay.
That's what it, yeah. Yeah, I feel like they had a show on Channel 4 that was very acclaimed in the last few years. Anyway, I didn't know that he was the kind of actor that could, like a serious actor that could do this kind of thing.
Okay.
He directed 3 episodes of 1,000 Blows, too.
Okay.
So we can probably expect more collaboration between him and Graham.
Yeah, like, seeing this pretty much right after seeing 1,000 Blows and a lot of the same people crop up in it. It's like, okay. These really are like a little community of people.
Yeah, because Darren Doherty is in this, too.
Yeah.
Graham and his wife, Hannah Walters, who once again shows up here, they become this little producing powerhouse. The people involved in making this seem to be making a lot, and it's all coming out in short order, basically. Now, having watched the whole thing just once, the third episode was my least favourite.
Oh, interesting.
Now,
that's the one that seemed to have garnered the most praise, isn't it?
Yeah. I think a lot of people would consider it the best. But while I like people in rooms talking, and this is a solid example of that, I did miss the movement.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? I liked moving about. I got into a rhythm of it. And though the camera is never locked in that episode, it's the room, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like, just keep it still then, if it's just that playing out in real time kind of thing. Like, there's a great scene in Hunger. The film, it's just a dialogue scene. The camera is just still, and we just watch them have the conversation like a play for however long, like 15 minutes or something. It's very good. The show disassembles, then reassembles you, then, just before departing, pokes one little hole in you again to see you off. Right? The final scene was great, though I did think the final lines would be... So they have a daughter as well. Stephen Graham and his wife, they have a daughter.
And she hasn't killed a person.
She hasn't killed, but she's kind of like a nice kid, a model student and all that kind of thing. And he's like, how do we make her, eh? And the wife is like, same way we made him. Like, right, good final line.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, no one's fault kind of thing. I thought it was a powerful send-off, but instead it's, I'm sorry, son, I should have done better, when he's like crying and hugging.
Yeah.
Now, fine. It's the most minute of nitpicks. I just thought the first was stronger as a full stop.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or an ellipsis, at least. It's a very good show.
Yes.
It's a very good show. Unfortunately, it's kind of become a political football.
It has.
Since being released.
Yeah.
And it's a shame, because on one side of the argument, the people who love it, I really disagree with them. but I like the show.
Yeah.
Do you know? So it's a complicated thing. It's not the show's fault it's become what it is.
Okay.
But like Keir Starmer...
Even though it's pretty upfront about what inspired this kid to do what he did and what kind of political sensibilities it's attacking.
Yeah. I don't think it's the wisest show in the world. I don't think it's the most helpful show in the world. I think they just sincerely wanted to like tell this story, you know, and Stephen Graham, like, I trust him. I've heard him speak about it. He's, you know, it's like he heard about these knife murders and he's like, what drives someone to do something like that? He seems like he has a good heart. Kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah.
But obviously the big thing is about toxic masculinity and about Andrew Tate and all that kind of, his name is mentioned once in the show, Andrew Tate.
Yeah.
But yeah, the idea of this kid is sort of part of the manosphere, but also it's not that simple because the girl who he killed was bullying him and yeah. calling him like an incel and all that kind of thing. So it's not clear cut. But the thing that people are taking away from it is like, oh, seeing the boy, how he behaves with the psychologist in episode 3 makes me worry for the future of men. And it's like, oh, it's just grow up. That's not, I am no different. I hate Andrew Tate. I hate that whole manosphere shit.
Yeah.
And they, you know, boys do need men around to like teach them how to, which is interesting because I feel like the last 10 years has been a lot of, oh, masculinity is no good for boys. Anyway.
Okay.
No, they need proper masculinity, you know, like, and I think there's a bit of danger in, like, it kind of, he happens in a vacuum, even though he's sort of in touch with that area of the internet.
Mm.
Like, the parents didn't abuse him, he was raised right and all that kind of thing. They say, oh, Stephen Graham is a bit angry sometimes. Like, oh, I once saw him, like, bust up a shed when he's frustrated he couldn't build it right.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's just everyone, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's every bloke, you get frustrated with something, you kick it about.
Well, they do, especially in that final episode, there's a couple of episodes that he has mm-hmm. where his kind of anger comes out.
Yeah.
But he's being, like, he's a victim in his own community now. Like, people are spray painting paedophile on his nonce. Van. Yeah. Nonce on his van. And
I saw this great article. It was like, obviously, an American article. It was like, revealed what the sign on the van means.
Oh, really?
Because they didn't have nonce.
Oh, shit, nonce. Okay.
So that was quite hilarious.
Okay.
It's also misspelled, I think. But yeah, if you're going to spray paint nonce on a van, you probably, yeah, I wouldn't imagine you're the most literate.
No, exactly. I guess, person. Yeah, you kind of take that for granted. That
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, foreign audiences would understand the,
yeah,
the
yeah.
slang. But yeah, and he's being followed around by kids on bikes. So like he tackles one off a bike and he's like holding him up.
Yeah, obviously like rumors have circulated that he was like kiddie fiddling basically. Yeah. And that's why his son went, you know.
Yeah. That's the thing. Like in those moments, his anger, it's extreme, like, but it's justified.
Of course, after yeah. a year of that, you know, yeah. you might snap once or twice.
Yeah.
And he goes home and apologizes and gets over it. It's like a normal person.
Yeah, man. Of course.
But yeah, so I think it's a bit dangerous to kind of imply, look, everything can be fine. I'm sure, like, kids that went on, like, the Columbine kids that go on to do these horrific things, their parents, every parent would never think their child could do... I think she says it in... Well, we're going to review it in a future episode. But there's a show, The Pit, where the mother's like, I'm sure my son wouldn't do anything, but I'm sure every mother thought that about their child.
Yeah.
That's true. But also, these things don't really happen in a vacuum. You know, like, stabbing a kid, that's... You know, but yeah, Keir Starmer has kind of made this free to all secondary schools, and it's been added like the GCSE curriculum or something
right,
like that.
Okay.
So it's like already is first of all, there's no distance from it, and secondly, it's like I heard Douglas Murray talk about it, and he was like, "Yeah, it's like a decent show. It's well acted and everything, and it's kind of interesting, but let's not pretend there's an epidemic of 13-year-old boys randomly stabbing."
Yeah.
There is a knife crime epidemic in the UK, but you're never going to get a show about that because for the obvious reasons.
Them being?
It's a black inner city problem.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's become this football, not the show's fault, but it is now, I feel, inextricably linked with all that stuff.
Mm.
It's the baby reindeer of the year. It's going to sweep all awards, you know, that it's eligible for. And it is a good show. I don't think it's a masterpiece. I've heard a lot of people say, it's like, well, the best show for years. It's a good show that's very well made. I do not think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, no, I'd be inclined to agree with that. Like, from a technical perspective, you kind of can't fault it, mm-hmm. can you? And it's interesting that, given the boiling point, didn't really have anything to say.
No, that's just about the hecticness of a kitchen.
Yeah, that they've kind of jumped to... They haven't just jumped up in terms of scale, they've jumped up in terms of, like, import, I suppose.
Yeah, like a message.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Which I guess is like, that's a good thing to do. It's like, all right, well, the first one was just to show that we knew what we were doing. Now let's make something about something.
I suppose the good thing about it, if anything, if nothing else, is Boiling Point was this unseen gem that we loved, but wasn't really talked about, didn't show up at awards or anything like that. And now this will make people go back to Boiling Point, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I recommend it, but with that kind of pinch of salt.
Yeah.
Novocaine, what's it about?
Jack Quaid.
Yes.
Jackery Quaid. He's back again.
Jackery Quaidlin.
The third. He's back again. This time, he's the protagonist, and he's playing a guy whose last name is Kane.
Mm.
And the reason he's called Novocaine, because it's a nickname that he actually has in the film. And the reason he has that nickname is because he can't feel pain.
That's right.
He has some sort of rare genetic disorder.
I think it's a real thing.
It is a real thing, because I remember there being an episode of House about it.
Okay.
And it's probably been covered in other medical dramas. But yeah, it's a rare genetic disorder, which means that he can't feel pain.
Yes.
He works at a bank. He's like a deputy manager at a bank. There's a girl who also works at the bank that he has a bit of a crush on. And one day she approaches him and is like, shall we go out on a date?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, yeah, all right.
Mm.
And then they do. And
if only he was that forthcoming. Actually, he's like, I don't know for a while, but we'll come to that.
Okay. But eventually they do go on this date. They have a nice time. They go out on another date. They have a nice time. They sleep together. Mm-hmm. Following day, the bank gets robbed.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets kidnapped. And his affection that he's built up for her in the very short amount of time that they've been together, combined with the fact that he knows he can't feel pain, galvanizes him to go off and be in an action film where he's going to get her back.
Right.
That is Novocaine.
That's Novocaine. Yeah. An action hero that is just not proficient but can't feel pain.
Yeah.
Now, Jack Quaid hasn't fully convinced me yet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's something just a bit beige about him to me.
Okay.
He's been in good things.
Yeah.
And he's not bad in them. I'm not saying that, like, he's not bad at all. I just haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
You know what I mean? That spark, that thing. When characters heal or feel no pain, their bodies are subjected to ludicrous strings of incidental violence.
Yeah.
We've talked about this before, you know. As soon as a character finds out they can heal, all of a sudden they get bisected by trains.
Yeah.
There's only one in this, really, like incidental thing. So not too bad. His initial behaviour with Amber Midthunder, the love interest, made me want to slap him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she asks him out, she's all over him, and he's reluctant.
Okay.
It's like, okay.
Well, would you not be a bit like...
No.
Ooh, what's going on here?
I mean, in my head,
Yeah.
But not, I'd just say yes, and really, I don't look a gift Midthunder in the mouth. there's a bit of, like, manic pixie dream girl to her. But you could chalk that up to being part of the spoiler alert act.
Yes.
Because she's in on the scheme.
Yeah.
Jacob Batalon, is that his name? His presence in the film is a reveal. That was annoying. The implication that I should care.
Okay.
You know, like the guy he's talking to, the guy from Spider-Man. That show.
Well, that was weird for me because I recognized his voice.
Oh, I didn't.
Okay. Because I recognized his voice, and they do a couple of things where, initially he's just a guy they
Ned. Played.
Ned.
Ned Weeks.
From Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, they play video games together,
And
over voice chat, he's like, oh yeah, I'm really ripped, and I get loads of girls, and I drive a Harley Davidson, and I'm just the coolest man. So immediately I knew what the gag was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end, like an hour and 10 minutes in, when you do eventually see him, it's like, yep, okay.
Yeah, well,
it's like a Marvel, this guy showed up.
Yeah, yeah, but he's wearing a motorcycle helmet, he takes it off, and it's like the camera zooms in. Yeah, it's a reveal.
Yeah.
And like that annoyed me. It's like, so fucking what?
Yeah.
It's not like Brad Pitt or someone, or even if you don't like them, you go, well, all right.
But I suppose you could argue that his reveal is a punchline, hence the attention it's given.
If you like, but it's really just that actor, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I had no problem with the comic set piece of him not wanting to hurt the first guy that he ends up in a fight with.
Yeah.
But in the heat of the fight, I feel like he wouldn't really care if the guy had burnt his hands. Because the guy burnt his hands on, like, they're in a kitchen.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, that rang false to me. Okay. Do you know what I mean? When he goes on to accidentally kill him, it kicked into a slightly different gear than I anticipated, given the first act.
Okay.
And there's some fun with injuries, but given the premise, I don't think they pushed it far enough.
Okay.
Far enough in terms of severity, just about, but not in invention.
Okay, because if I'm remembering correctly, every death in the film requires him to hurt himself.
Yeah.
So they are using it. They're using it, but
it's just given what you can do with that, it didn't feel creative enough to me.
He does stab the last guy with his broken arm. His own broken arm.
Did you not feel watching it, like, given what the setup was, this should just be more? Didn't you feel that?
I don't know, because the thing is, you have to keep in mind, yes, he can't feel pain.
Yeah.
But he is still mortal.
Yeah, he can't, of course, he can't chop his arm off. No, of course. But didn't you have that feeling? Didn't you feel like he was operating on, like, an eighth and, like, you just got to get to 10. Come on, you're nearly... It's the one to sneeze. It's that feeling.
I suppose... I mean, you're talking purely in terms of the action, the creativity.
Yeah,
the
like all of it, really. Like, it's an Edgar Wright type film, isn't it? And you're kind of waiting for it to, like, come on, I know you can do it.
Okay.
And it all stayed at a certain level.
Because I would certainly say that in terms of the comedy.
Yeah.
Because it's a comedy action film.
Yeah.
I would call it charming rather than funny, because I never laughed at it, but okay. I appreciated what it was doing at times, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it would be a better comic book series. Like, the spirit of which it feels like it's trying to partly replicate anyway.
Okay.
But I think that would be a great opportunity to come up with interesting scenarios.
You're thinking about it. There is actually, like, at the end of the film, when he does a costume change with Ned from Spider-Man.
Yeah. When he's, he's finally...
Yeah, and Novocaine. Now he's Novocaine, though, like, what's Novocaine?
Yeah, exactly.
Who is this person? I've also seen there's that promotional image online of him holding the gun in that final costume. And a lot of people have been circulating, like, he'd be perfect to play, like,
Max Payne. Yes.
So I do wonder if there is a bit of intention, like, in terms of the filmmakers. Not Max Payne specifically.
Yeah.
But, like,
selling him as, like, an action
hero. Yeah, we want to make this guy a thing.
Well, it's that iconography, isn't it? It's the John Wick thing of, like, just implying now he's Novocaine, even though we have no frame of reference for Novocaine.
It's funny you bring up John Wick, actually, because the poster... is very... It feels like it's almost deliberately an homage to the John Wick 2 poster.
Right.
You know the John Wick 2 poster where there's, like, it's John Wick in the middle of the poster.
Multiple guns.
And guns all around him.
Yes,
and in Novocaine, it's Jack Quaid, like, pressed up against the glass.
Yeah.
With, like, pizza cutters and like, that's scissors and all things around him.
Yeah, okay.
So it feels like it is deliberately trying to make you think of John Wick.
Yes. Look, I can't say I found it particularly funny or exciting.
Okay.
It's nowhere near as funny as it should be. I didn't laugh at all.
Okay.
It's okay, though. Like, the only major problem for me was the ending. Like, because he starts off being asocial. You know, he has, like, a bladder timer because he doesn't feel when he needs to pee and all that kind of thing. And I know, like, now at the end, he's social and open to living a bit more on the edge. Like, Shaun's Adventurous with two sugars at the end of Shaun the Dead.
Yes.
It's that kind of thing, isn't it? Ooh, Adventurous. But he shouldn't have still been with her. She's arrested as being complicit in the scheme and she's in jail. It's a nice final image of him eating the pie.
Because that's another thing. Yeah. He doesn't eat because he's worried he's going to bite his own tongue off.
Yes. So he has, not milkshakes.
Like liquids. He just drinks liquids. Yeah, he blends things up and everything.
Yeah, that's it.
And that's kind of, I think that's one of the things that happens on his date with Amber Midthunder.
Yeah.
That kind of endears him to her. Mm-hmm. Is that she encourages him to eat pie for the first time. And he's like, oh my God, this is fucking amazing.
Yeah, and I get that's like a good step in the relationship sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think it would have had greater power if he'd refused earlier in the film. Like, no, I won't, you know?
Yeah.
And then at the end he does. But I still left with a sense that his self-esteem must still be pretty low then. This girl completely manipulated him.
Yeah.
And he just forgave her. She's hot. I get it.
Yeah, she is Amber Midthunder.
I get it. But come on, man. You're letting the squad down or whatever.
No,
like,
it's...
No, you can't... No! The true ending of that is, like, she is sorry and wants to be with him. He's like, no... Novocaine's gained the power of self-respect. That's the ending, right?
No, don't fucking quote Scott Pilgrim at me.
But that's
when you're making a point.
But that's the whole point of the ending of Scott Pilgrim is Scott's gained the power of love. That's not enough. He has to love himself.
Okay.
That's the point, isn't it? And then he gains the power of self-respect. So I was a bit like, you cuck. But,
right.
But I didn't think it was bad. It was okay. It just needed to be like... It didn't get there. It didn't go up to 11.
I did. The ending did leave me on a bit of like a... Oh.
Right.
Because, he goes to eat the pie. Like, he's at visitation with her, and she's getting out in like a few months. So they're kind of celebrating that.
Yeah.
So he has a piece of pie. And then as she's taken back to her cell, he eats the pie.
Yes.
And I thought, well, this is a comedy action film, so the film is going to end with him biting his tongue off.
Right.
And it doesn't.
It would have definitely undermined, like, because the film is not as anarchic. Maybe that's kind of what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The film's not as anarchic as that. Like, what I would have really loved, darker, but the whole film, he's had appendicitis.
Oh, right.
His appendix bursts at the end, he just drops dead. Like, I would have liked that. But yeah, that's kind of all I have to say about it.
Okay.
I wouldn't discourage people from seeing it.
No, I think it's definitely worth a watch. And I think it will be enough for some people.
Okay.
I kind of get what you mean about, like, yeah. I would have loved it if it would push itself a bit further.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I wouldn't say no to a better version of the film that we got. I think what we got is fine, though.
Okay.
It's the type of film where I could see them making more, and if they do make more, I would want those to be improvements.
I suppose, because it's a strong central premise.
Yeah.
And so, I they didn't milk it as much as they could have done. Like, if they're thinking of sequels, you put everything into the one film, don't
yeah.
you? Yeah, it's like, oh, that's ripe. And there are sometimes you see films with a central premise, like, oh, I hadn't thought... The Banshees of Inisherin. You're like, why haven't I seen that kind of film before?
Yeah.
And it feels like I got everything I needed out of that. Like, I'm edified.
Yeah.
And I wasn't edified after Noah of Ken. It was like, great potential.
Yeah.
That's kind of it.
Okay. I think it's still a recommendation from me.
Okay.
I wouldn't discourage people from watching it.
I agree with the second part. The quote Morgan Freeman. Okay. Seven. Okay, The Electric State.
Now this one... Well, this is an interesting one, isn't it?
Is it?
I mean, no.
Well, I'll say off the interesting, bat, we're not going to be able to talk about this any further without our opinion becoming clear. This is a bad film.
It is a bad film, and I thought it was bad. And
yes.
I think it took me 3 sittings to get through it.
Okay.
Though, consequently, I didn't have as bad a time with it as I have with other films I've seen this year.
Okay.
Because I pushed myself to watch it was this one. I was like, no, I'm going to take breaks.
I got through it in one, but for reasons I will go on to explain, I didn't have as bad a time with it as I might have done either.
And I think this is probably the one interesting aspect of it, is that it has been dragged through the coals on Rotten Tomatoes. A lot of people have given this scathing reviews. Like, one of the worst reviewed of the year, mm-hmm. if not the worst reviewed, in terms of, like, above a certain level.
Yeah, of course.
And... that does surprise me a little bit.
A bit.
Because it looks like the type of film, and this might sound a bit, like, pompous, and I don't mean it to, but this felt like the type of film that most people would think is okay.
Right.
It's got that kind of, like, Marvel, because it's directed by the Russos.
Not critics.
And it's not critics.
Not critics, yeah. But people, yeah. I mean, I don't know what the audience score is on Rotten Tomatoes.
I think the audience score is also not very good.
Okay.
Maybe even worse than critics, but I don't know for certain.
Okay. I would be surprised by that.
Yeah.
That would surprise me.
But no, it does. It feels like the type of film... It feels like if this had the Marvel logo...
Yeah.
It would be like, 67%, it's fine for what it is.
Okay, I would go like more toward 50. I don't know where it is sitting. What is it, like 20s, is it? We're talking...
Oh, I think it's teens.
It's teens, okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's not that bad.
No.
I'll say that, it's not that bad. What's it about?
So Millie Bobby Brown is a precocious young woman.
Is she?
She's also in this film.
Yeah.
And, she lives in a world, as does everyone else, where robots exist.
Mm.
And they kind of try to start their own little civil war.
Yeah.
Led by Mr. Peanut.
Yeah.
Which I never clocked during the film that was a brand tie-in. Like a genuine real-world brand tie-in.
I cheered on Mr. Peanut.
Yeah.
I think I Googled it when it was on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was one of those things I wasn't aware of while I was watching it. But now, having watched the film and now I'm aware of it, it's like, oh, that's really shit.
Yes.
That, yeah, they're like the main, the rebel leader of the robots is an actual real...
An actual mascot.
A mascot. Yeah. But yeah, they try to start their own civil war. Humans go to war with the robots, they're losing, but then this, like, billionaire tech guy creates an army of drones and the humans win. So the robots are kind of sent off to this kind of seclusion zone.
District 9.
Yeah, they live in the desert on their own, away from people. But that drone technology is kind of retro, it's reworked and it's sold to the masses. It's like a sort of Ready Player One.
Yeah.
You get to live in your own virtual reality. Actually, no, what it does is it, like, partitions your brain.
Yeah.
So, like, half of you can be in work and half of you can be on a beach in Hawaii at the same time.
Right, okay.
And I think that's one of the many things in this film that never comes up.
I don't even remember that.
Yeah.
I'm taking your word for it.
Yeah, no, as soon as it's raised, it's like, oh, okay, so this is going to be a comment on, like, the half of them that's working is forced to always work.
Mm-hmm.
But the company have plausible deniability because they're like, well, you're always on holiday.
Yeah,
as well,
yeah.
So we can just make humanity work constantly.
Right.
None of that ever comes up.
Right.
The corporation is still evil.
Yes.
But it's evil for different vaguer reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than...
Basically, Millie Bobby Brown, her brother has died? No.
Her brother was a genius, but now, I think he's dead now.
But then she finds out that he might not be dead.
Yeah.
So she wants to go and find him, bumping into Chris Pratt along the way, who's doing his Han Solo thing.
Yeah.
Then they go together and they find out the robots that have been excommunicated from the world, they're actually not that bad.
Yeah.
And the bad robots are now run by Stanley Tucci's evil billionaire.
Yeah.
War ensues. Yes. That's the film.
Yeah.
Well, it's a shame that a good title's been wasted. The Electric State, I like that as a title.
It's a shame that, from what I understand, good source material has been wasted.
It's based on a book, right?
A
picture book.
Yeah, it's not a book that I was familiar with prior to the film. Mm-hmm. And I do think...
No.
No.
You don't do books.
No, no. But it's not one of those books that, it's big enough...
It's not Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't need to be Harry Potter for me to have heard of it. I brought up Blood Meridian, not that long ago.
Because I've read it, and I told you about it.
Yeah, so it's not a book that I've looked into, but from what I've heard from discussions of people who have seen this film, it's sort of like a picture book.
Yes, picture book, yeah.
It's like a graphic novel. It's basically these kind of landscape paintings.
Yeah.
With... dead robot carcasses.
Yeah.
And it paints a picture of this war that happened in the past.
Yes.
And now everyone's kind of living in this kind of technology dystopia, but they're not really aware of it.
Okay.
And it's all conveyed through the pictures. And it seems like, anything would be better than what we got.
Yeah.
And this film is certainly not what that source material appears to be doing. It seems to be a lot more subtle and kind of...
Yeah, maybe it's
devastation.
Maybe it's kind of unadaptable in its... in the form it exists, you know? But then, just don't do it then. Do something else.
Yeah.
Inspired by it or something.
Yeah. But no, it's taken something that seems to be almost quietly devastating.
Right.
And it's turned it into a Marvel film, basically.
Something devastatingly loud.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a mishmash of various robot-y properties, right? So, bit of District 9, like I said, bit of Avatar, bit of Pacific Rim, bit of Ready Player One, like you said, bit of Transformers. In particular, the Bumblebee speaking through voice clips thing.
Yep, they do that.
I don't like Millie Bobby Brown.
No.
She isn't one thing or the other. She can just about get away with...
She's neither Bobby nor Brown.
Exactly. Well, she's definitely not Brown.
Okay.
No, she... that ageless vacuum she exists in, you know?
Right.
That, P. Diddy or, adult, not sure what's going on with her thing. She could just about get away with Enola Holmes, but not the action heroine in Damsel, not the punky rabble in this. Chris Pratt is back, yes, doing his vaguely Han Solo thing again, minus the charisma. It's not his fault, really. Giancarlo Esposito features.
In yet another thing.
He's introduced with him giving maximum Esposito face.
Yeah.
It's just...
No. The whole thing is his maximum Esposito face.
Yeah.
But
he's not a bad guy.
This must have been the easiest thing he's ever done.
Yeah.
Because 90% of his screen time, maybe even 95% of his screen time, is a close-up of his face...
On a screen. Yeah, yeah. Just looking like Giancarlo Esposito.
Yeah. It could, for all we know, it could have been a picture of his face.
That's how static it is. Yeah. It's just beyond with him now. Action stars do action films, I get it. There are types. But Esposito is an actual actor.
Yeah.
He can act. It's like he's lost a bet. Do you know what I mean? I will say he's not at full power for much of the film, right? But still very much Esposito face. I think I knew at one point that Ki Hai Kwan was in it, but it was nevertheless a depressing surprise when he popped up.
Okay.
The film wastes the likes of Stanley Tucci, Holly Hunter, Brian Cox, and Coleman Domingo. Jason Alexander also makes a brief appearance in a thin spot of legacy casting. The robots aren't charming or endearingly goofy. They're just weird and garish.
Yeah, all of the robots felt like it was the same kind of robot.
Yeah.
They do have... They are visually distinct from each other.
Yeah.
But in terms of their personality...
The same family of robot.
Yeah, they all just kind of felt like... initially, when I knew nothing about this film, I thought it was like a Five Nights at Freddy's ripoff.
Okay.
Because they all seem to have this kind of mascot-y...
Yes. A lot of them literally are.
A lot of them literally are mascots. But they're all just kind of they're mascot children's robots that have turned evil.
Yeah.
Whereas in reality, they are... Yeah, they're all just kind of like... Yeah, they all kind of are mascot. They're built to be to have these little personalities. Yeah.
And like, I like that the styles are hyper-individual. Robots, like, resembling donuts and ice creams and the like. But the designs are bloated and tacky.
Yeah.
Now, that's kind of by design, to an extent.
Yeah.
Mascots being, you know, corporate tackiness.
But that seems to be all there is. They don't have any just, like, they don't have any, like, Boston Dynamics, like, purely functional robots.
No. But I just like that it's not one of those where they all look the same. They do literally, every one is different, yeah. Right? So I'll give it that. The aesthetic is somewhat Fallout, the game, that is.
Yeah.
Meets Takeshi's Castle.
Okay.
Which sounds fun, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The Russo brothers were like, well, let's make it not that.
Oh.
You know those big things, Takeshi's Castle, like the, you know, the people in the costumes after like bumping off things. It's that kind of vibe. Or like a Power Rangers villain, you know?
Yeah.
Woody Harrelson voices head robot Mr. Peanut. Now, Mr. Peanut is a real world mascot, like you said, whose real quote unquote name is Bartholomew Richard Fitzgerald Smythe.
Okay.
He's a British gentleman. Right. I guess Harrelson was going for the your Tammy Prospector, but it does not work.
No.
It wants to be a somewhat old school action adventure film. One of the key ingredients for that genre is humor.
Mm.
Now, the Electric State isn't funny.
No.
It has sassy robots that swear a bit. One robot makes a dick joke. When he thinks his robot companion has died, Chris Pratt confesses that he thought of him as more than a friend, which is just uncomfortable.
Yeah.
There's a moment where Chris Pratt tells Millie Bobby Brown to use a fake name, Veronica. She says, Veronica, with a B. And then he says, no, have you ever heard of someone named Veronica? And she says, yes, actually. That's a joke.
Oh, that was a joke?
That's a joke.
Oh, right. Okay.
That's a joke. Especially towards the end, they try to insert poignancy and pathos. And you ask yourself, hang on, was this meant to be alive? You know what I mean? Like, it's sparkless, it's soulless, its tone is misguided. Are we supposed to take seriously the violence is not the answer, we wanted peace speech when it comes from Mr. Peanut?
Yeah, because they are really trying to, like...
Yeah, it's Martin taken Luther seriously. It's taken seriously, yeah. Unbelievably, yes, we are supposed to take it seriously. The soundtrack includes a piano rendition of Wonderwall for some reason as well.
Mm.
I yearn for proper throwback Quest movies. This isn't one, right?
No.
But I think the fact it was even aspiring to it kept my hatred at bay for the longest time. And when it ended, I don't think I hated it. It's big and dumb and basically inoffensive, and there's nothing to recommend it. But I don't know, it did inspire bitter contempt, mostly apathy.
Yeah. Well, it's just another failure from the Russos, isn't it? Like, yeah. Outside of Community and the stuff they've done with Marvel, they really don't seem to produce anything.
No, it's also another Netflix nothing, right? Yeah. Like, this cost them $320 million.
Yeah.
A dire indictment of these streaming mockbusters. It's just burning money. Again, I just think of that scene in The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
The Joker just burns the massive pile of cash. Yeah, it's bad. Bad, bad film.
Yeah.
But I didn't have hatred for it.
No. What were you talking about before? Was it Your Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man? When we were doing our review of that, you were like... Because you said, oh, it's got like 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
At the time, at the very least. And I was like, what?
Mm.
And you were like, yeah, I know what you mean, but like, why would you give it a bad review?
Yes.
This is kind of the inverse of that.
Yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, it's not the worst thing I've ever seen, but why would you give it a good review?
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's why it's got 12% or whatever it is.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't, I'm probably not going to remember it. I think if I'm going to remember anything about it, it might be the Anthony Mackie robot, where he goes in like bigger versions of himself. And then...
When I think of it, all I think of is the scene where they're like in the bunker with all the robots.
Okay.
And you see like the ice cream robot and the...
Okay.
That's the film for me. I don't really... I'll remember Veronica.
Yeah.
Like that $320 million film. And that was like a suitable, funny moment. Put some money into the writers.
Yeah.
For God's sake. Obviously, we don't recommend it.
Not a recommendation.
No. Okay. The Monkey.
Monkey.
Monkey. What's this one about?
It's about a monkey.
Okay.
He plays a drum.
Yeah.
He's a toy.
He's a toy monkey.
He's a toy monkey. And whenever he plays a drum, someone dies in a funny, gruesome way.
That's it. It's based on a Stephen King short story.
It is.
Their babysitter, and this is named Annie Wilkes. Misery.
Any connection, do you think?
Well, I think it's just a reference to Stephen King.
Okay.
Because obviously that's the Kathy Bates character in Misery.
Yeah.
There's also a Psycho reference in the opening scene in the pawn shop, where we see a taxidermied bird behind the owner.
Okay.
Now, Osgood Perkins, the director, is, of course, the son of Anthony Perkins, who played Norman Bates in the original Psycho.
Oh, fun. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when we reviewed Long Legs, I think I talked about the nature of his parents' deaths. I think I did.
Oh, yeah, this is actually ringing a bell. Yeah. Yeah.
His father, Anthony Perkins, he was a closeted gay guy for most of his life. After he came out, he remained married to his wife and later died of AIDS. And then that wife, so Osgood Perkins' mother, was in one of the hijacked planes on 9/11.
Yes,
that flew into the towers.
Yeah.
All of that very much informs the approach to this film. Os Perkins has spoken about his parents dying in, quote, insane headline-making ways. And he said, like, the initial script that was brought to him was very serious.
Mm.
But he wanted to infuse it with, like, a sense of glib randomness.
Yeah. Know?
And I think that was the correct conclusion.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Or at least a different and interesting one. Like, to go into it with a smile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, there's another world where this was another imaginary. Where it was just kind of a humorless, soulless, not very interesting horror film.
Yes.
But as soon as you start playing it for that kind of like wry,
yeah,
like slightly disturbed kind of
humor, the gallows humor, yeah,
it completely like changes the film.
Absolutely. And also, yeah, this isn't Long Legs. Like,
no,
that film had its moments of being so bonkers it tipped into humor. This is self-consciously going for darkly funny,
yeah,
basically through and through. The gore is fun. Yeah, it's like it's mostly CG gore, of which we are not fans, but I think many of the deaths here have to be.
Yeah, and I think the creativity of the deaths
does
make up for it.
Absolutely.
And there is some stuff where it does feel like they I trust that they're doing it practically whenever they can.
Yeah, like 100%.
There's a death where someone's in a sleeping bag and they get trampled to death by like 100 horses.
Yeah.
And I think the horses are CG. Or you see like the sleeping bag getting trampled by CG legs.
Yeah, yes.
But when they open up the sleeping bag, it's just like a slurry.
A slop. Yeah.
Slop.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, they're trying to do it in the most practical way they can.
Yeah, they're doing what they can. Because also it's not the highest budget film in the
world. No, it's not. But I think that kind of, that's what's different about it. They've built up enough goodwill in the way that they're trying to present those deaths.
We forgive the CG gore.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like Tatiana Maslany, who plays their mother. Mm. I quite liked its aesthetic. It's very smoothly executed. The monkey is quite creepy and silly. And in the end, isn't life really just a monkey beating the death snare at arbitrary will? Like, when you think about it. There are funny edits. So one of the brothers... Because basically, if you turn the key of this monkey, someone's going to die, right? But not the person who turned the key.
No.
And they start... The brothers, when they're young, they start to think, like, is the monkey responsible for what's going on? And one of the brothers gets the monkey out of the box, whatever, and it's like, no, don't do it. And he's like, I'm going to do it. And it cuts, he starts to turn it, and it cuts to the face of their uncle at the funeral.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, okay, so it's a proper sense of humor.
Yeah.
There are jump scares, but I didn't mind because this is pure popcorn, you know? Yeah. It's probably not diverging much from the events of the short story. Perkins has just tilted his head, squinted at the material, and attacked it with a wink, right? It's like all the residents of the town dying in quick succession. For instance, so at the moment I'm making my way through the Stephen King bibliography.
Okay.
And I can imagine, I can see those passages written straight-faced, you know?
Yeah.
But here it's not done. It's like, and then Mrs. O'Leary got hit with the lawnmower, you know, and it's done in a splatter, fun kind of way.
Yeah.
I like that it wasn't a depiction of brothers that grew up at odds, but then bond through the experience of the film. It continues to pit them against each other. It then resolves all that with a dash of Mork, which disappointed me a bit, before hastily and blessedly reaffirming that it is more irreverent than that.
Yes.
You know, they have their moment where they reconnect, and that moment passes.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's probably a one and done kind of thing, but it was a good time.
Yeah.
Short and sour. There's a nice dose of nastiness in the violence, but never enough to make it a nasty film. It's sardonic. Mm. You know, it's a sarcastic film, but not cruel. And it leaves us with a devilish cackle of a final image.
It does, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd recommend it.
Yeah, I think I would. No, I definitely would.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I definitely would recommend it. Because, yeah, it doesn't feel like it's... Like, it is mindless gratuity, but, like, in a fun way. It doesn't feel like it's being nasty for the sake of it.
It's not a nasty film.
Yeah.
There's some nastiness, like I said, in the gore. But you just feel like, oh, everyone was, like, on board. It's not exploitative. Everyone was having a good time.
Yeah, certainly Theo James, who kind of double dips in this film. He plays both brothers, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And... I suppose if I had one nitpick,
mm-hmm.
the priest
Yeah.
Who is he played by, Oz Perkins, or is it just a random guy?
I think Oz Perkins plays their uncle.
Oh, their uncle. Right, yeah, yeah. Okay. I knew Oz Perkins was like somewhere. I don't know if he was the priest or not. Yeah, I think it's at that funeral for the uncle. The priest kind of like comes to the podium and he sees like the body or like something makes him go, right. Oh, well.
Yeah, yes, yes.
And then he's just talking about
remembering now.
Yeah, and he's giving like a really bad eulogy about it's all just like fucking, what the hell, dude?
Yeah,
like
a nihilistic sermon.
Yeah, that didn't quite gel with the rest of the film.
Yeah, that's more mainstream American comedy tone. Is that what you mean?
Well, just like, kind of. Like, it's not as broad as that.
It's not as broad as that, no, but like,
but it's
just a priest giving an inappropriate sermon. Yeah. Is sort of, yeah, it's beneath this film. Almost.
But it didn't feel, I'm fine with the priest giving an inappropriate sermon, but it's one of, it has to be written in a way where the priest doesn't think it's inappropriate.
Sure.
Like, you kind of, you're tuning into it and you're going, oh, actually, this is...
Yeah, it's surreal. It's
This is just a sermon that, like, no priest would be allowed to deliver this.
Right.
So, and that kind of broke it a little bit for me.
I get you.
And it seems weird because, like, oh, it's like a Toy Monkey film. And, like, some of the deaths, even in context, the deaths are ridiculous. There's a woman that gets completely annihilated with a shotgun blast. Yeah. And I know that there are certain calibers of bullets. Yeah.
I can't remember. What happens to her, exactly?
Well, the shotgun kind of falls over. And she gets shot. And literally nothing is left. She is...
Of the whole body. The
whole body is blown to smithereens.
Okay, that is a bit...
Yeah.
But...
Because I know that a shotgun can do some damage.
Oh, yes, it can. Yes,
but even as far as shotgun blasts go, it's like she's been blown up by a bomb.
Wherever you got shot would blow up.
Yeah.
You wouldn't blow up.
Yeah. No, she blows up.
She blows up. Okay.
And I can attribute that to, that's the film being fun and silly.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
The priest didn't feel like the film was being dumb and silly. He just felt the film was being dumb.
Sure. Okay. I suppose I would have a similar feeling. It's better than Novocaine, I think.
Yeah,
like, for me, certainly. So. But a similar problem where it's not quite the 11. It's really good.
No, I wouldn't. I certainly don't think it's fair to give it the same criticism as Novocaine.
No, absolutely. No, it does a lot more with what it is.
Yeah.
But like I said, it's a one and done. Like, I have no impulse to go back to it. And I think if it was like mad. Novocaine's like a 7. This is a 10, you know, out of 11.
Okay.
So yeah, not the same criticism, but it's sort of coming from the same place. Do you know what I mean? Which is... I think if this had been a little bit crazier in places, I would have more of an impulse to go back to it. But I did like it a lot, and I would recommend it.
Yeah, I would recommend it too.
Okay, Snow White. Disney's Snow White. Okay, well, it's Snow White.
Is it?
Well, it's still a musical, right? It's still a musical, different songs, which are boring and forgettable.
Yeah. But also the Snow White songs as well.
Some of the original songs, yes. It does not... I mean, there's no point explaining... That's what I'm saying. The premise is not important, right? It's Snow White. They've changed things.
Yes, they have.
But it's, for all intents and purposes, it's Snow White. It does not in any way justify its existence.
No.
It's been a long time since I saw... Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, but it's not something that requires an update, really.
Okay.
The CG is bad. The whole thing is Mufasa adjacent. The dwarves are uncanny and grotesque. Gal Gadot is woeful. When the evil queen is in hag mode, the eyes don't match the makeup.
Mm.
At one point, Jonathan, so the updated prince, there's not a prince anymore.
Mm.
It's a guy called Jonathan. he says, oh, you must have mistaken me for a man in shining armor. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, honk.
Yeah.
At one point, Doc refers to a liminal space where ethics and motives are ill-defined. So, Sam's Lexus Center.
Samuel. Words. Phrases. Sam's Lexus
Center.
So this is when we've talked about it in many formats before. When dialogue, often in its precociousness... nihilism or sophistication, clashes with the tone of its host product or character, typically intended for comic effect.
Okay.
So that would be like, what was that thing in Super Mario Brothers? That little thing going, the star?
Yeah.
The Everything means nothing. All shit like that, right? And I'm going to call that context linguistic inconsonance or Colin.
Right, okay.
So you could say they're doing a Colin or they Colined.
Okay.
Either's acceptable. But yes, Colin.
Samuel. Words. Phrases. Sam's lexic.
Center. So Doc Collins.
Doc, yeah, or did a Colin.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe Colin would be. Yeah, Doc didn't do a Colin. I don't want to think about what that would mean. Rachel Ziegler is fine for the most part.
Okay, I was annoyed by her in this.
Okay, I'm annoyed by her in life.
I mean, that's the thing. It's kind of, it is difficult. And I think Disney knew this because I think she's had a bit of a slap on the wrist from Disney.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly, like, as this film has been coming out. Mm-hmm. I mean, they cancelled the premiere outright, didn't they? Yes. And it's hard to know whether that was because of Rachel Ziegler's very, like, not very careful campaign that she's been running around this film.
Yeah, yeah.
Where she's like, oh, it's not your grandparents, Snow White.
Yeah, like, that was so antiquated.
Yeah, this is like the 2020s. Yeah, women don't belong to anyone.
Right.
It's hard not to think of that when she's playing this sweet, innocent... Oh, I'm just so pure and lovely.
Okay.
Oh, I don't hate anyone. Oh, is it, when you know that this is what the... It's hard to know, like, in terms of the premiere and everything, it's hard to know how much of it is that and how much of that is Gal Gadot being
Israel Palestine.
Role. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I really just try and avoid that stuff as much as I possibly can.
Yeah.
You got to try and just focus. I know some things you can't separate, right? Just focusing on her performance in the film, she comes across as the presenter of a children's educational show,
yes,
right? Especially with the dwarves, like the tonally. That's on point, I think.
Yeah, that's the thing. She clearly understood the assignment.
Yes.
She can sing. I think she's doing what the film is asking of her.
Yes.
So I'm not being critical of her in the
no,
sense
No, I get you.
I just didn't like the performance.
The fact is, it's not for us, yeah. Right? That's the thing. It's that her performance illustrates the fact that this is pitched young.
Yeah.
Which is fine. You know, it's Snow White. Consequently, for us, it can be an uncomfortable watch, right? It often induces cringe.
Yeah.
So her teaching Dopey how to whistle, the earnestness of the songs, the dwarves and the bandits dancing together, the broadness of it can be embarrassing. The mirror too. It's very hard not to think of Shrek.
Yes.
Watching this. So there's an actual midget in Jonathan's band of outlaws.
Yeah.
The midget's presence feels like a proof of concept. Like, if we were going to do this again, would that work?
Yeah.
You know? Because it's certainly an improvement.
Yeah. Am I right in saying that at one point that band of Jonathan's were the dwarves?
Now, I've heard this. Okay. I've also heard people from inside the film saying that's not the case.
Okay.
So I don't know who to believe.
Okay.
But it would feel weird, like, again, so we're an age we can't have seven midgets.
Yeah.
So, but it's strange to have six full grown men and one midget.
Yeah.
And they're the dwarves now. I don't know, it's a weird thing.
It's just like, it's the diversity of that group.
Yeah.
Combined with the fact that there are seven of them.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Combined with the fact that I don't think they were in the original material.
I'm willing to believe it. Just having one midget is weird. I mean, it's also weird the fact that we have seven.
Not really, it's just like, oh, that's our olive branch to the community.
But it's like we have seven CGI dwarves and then an actual midget. That's also weird. They just didn't get it right, did they? They could not get this right.
Well, this was all because Peter Dinklage said his, like, oh, you can't have
the bastard.
Yeah. And then everyone was like, fuck you for speaking on our behalf, Peter Dinklage. What the fuck's wrong with
you? We don't get much work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This
seven,
is like the one thing we can count
plum
on.
Plum rolls right
Yeah.
Now. Yeah.
And there were a ton of reshoots that were done in the wake of those comments. I don't know if they were connected to them.
Well, like Peter Dinklage is Supreme Midget, isn't he? He is the boss. He isn't the main shorty, main principal.
Well, he certainly seems to be talking
person.
As though he is, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Like thinking he can speak on behalf of an entire community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know if the reshoots were directly connected to that. But yeah, a ton of reshoots were done.
Yes.
And so it does feel like a lot of things have been reworked behind the scenes.
But like, when he's on screen, you just keep thinking how much better it would look, at least.
Yeah.
Like, not necessarily be. But
I don't know, though, because the forest is basically entirely CG.
No, I just mean that the dwarves would look better if they were real people.
The dwarves would certainly look better. Yeah. But I'm just thinking, like, instead of having one person in this entirely CG plane, you'll have eight. And I don't know if that would even be that much better necessarily.
Yeah. But yeah, like, you're right. It also feels like he's a token to buy some goodwill. Like, well, if he's fine with it.
Yeah.
You know? Plus, Jonathan wears green as he leads these bandits. So it really is just Robin Hood.
Okay.
And again, Shrek. Then I thought, oh no. What if there's a twist that he is Robin Hood And this is the first entry in a live-action Disneyverse.
Oh, no.
Because doesn't seem like a stretch, does it?
Well, it would be such a bizarre time to do it.
Yeah.
Because they've been doing these for years.
But every fucker is doing it.
What was the first? Was it Maleficent? Was that the first one?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that was like 2012 or something.
Yeah, like 12, 14, something 12, like that.
14.
Yeah, yeah.
So why would you wait this long? Do you do all of these live-action remakes? Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, oh, but now we're going to start connecting them.
Yeah. Well, like the universe thing, we had the MCU, but just that wasn't a thing, really, back in 2012. It definitely is now.
Yeah.
And so I could see them going, now, okay, let's do it now. Snow White feels like a good... It's the Iron Man. It's like the entry.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, because that feels right, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Snow White would be your first film in the LADCU or whatever.
Okay.
And Snow White, like, meeting Robin Hood in the forest, all of them rebelling against the Queen, that feels exactly like how you get that going,
okay.
That universe, right? What's more, when the Evil Queen is ultimately sucked into the void within / beyond the mirror,
yeah.
I did think, Looking Glass.
Oh, right? Oh, yeah, okay.
They're element. Now, they didn't do any of that.
No,
that didn't happen.
Thank God.
But I regard it as one might making it through severe turbulence on an aeroplane. A grateful dodge.
Thank God the worst didn't happen. Yeah.
Or a portent. We'll see.
Okay.
Because can't you just see that? Like, we have an Alice in Wonderland film, and then she goes to Wonderland, and she meets the Evil Queen that's now, like, the Queen of Hearts or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. There's a lot of Evil Queen.
Stop it. Yes. Someone might take that idea.
So the poor quality of the production makes the Snow White story seem like a fucking mad fever dream. Right? When you watch the original, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, sure, it's odd, like Seven Dwarves and all that, but it is what it is. Now, because they look so horrible and it all looks so horrible, you're like, this idea is mad. Like, who came up with this idea? It's hard to get through. It's interminable. It just keeps happening and then it ends and you're thankful. And now I would like some commendation and recognition for avoiding using any dwarf name puns in my review.
Okay.
That would make me happy.
Right. I think I have questions.
Yeah.
You alluded to it in the beginning of the review. They have changed things. She's obviously, Rachel Zegler is not a white person.
No. She passes, but she's not.
She passes, but she's not a white person. And so Snow White can no longer be called Snow White because her skin is white as snow.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way they get around it now is she was born in a snowstorm.
Right.
Hence, she's called Snow White because her parents were like, oh, what should we, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Also, the Queen...
Which is kind of an element of disillification, isn't it?
A little bit.
Because, like, the idea, like, oh, the character's called Snow White because she's white. How, like, yeah, that's... It's a fairy tale.
Yeah.
Yes, that's why she's called Snow White.
Yeah.
You know?
Also, the Queen is not jealous of Snow White's beauty anymore. She's jealous of her purity.
She doesn't like her stance on Palestine.
Yeah, because, like, when she asks the mirror who's the fairest of them all... It seems like what she's referring to now is, like, fairness of spirit.
Yeah,
like
her character.
Her character. Yeah, yeah. And for a while, it's the Queen. But then when Snow White, like, gives someone some bread or whatever she does, the mirror is like, oh, actually, she's, like, the most pure person.
Oh, fair play.
Yeah. It's like, I see you now, Snow White. And so the Queen is like, right, well, we've got to sort this out. And that kicks off the events of the film.
So this is like an internal... Like, if you're going to do that, like, there's just an inherent... paradox in that if you're the type to ask the mirror who's the fairest of them all,
you
are by definition not.
You can't, be.
Anyone who wants to become president kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Shouldn't be. Yeah.
But why is it that the Queen was the fairest person of them all before Snow White?
Yeah.
What kind of bastards are living in that village?
Where the Evil Queen
is
the standard for goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
What did Dopey ever do?
Yeah, I assume it's including the dwarves in that. Not even Happy is like the fairest of them all.
And that's just proper segregation. Like, no, we don't count
they're
dwarves.
They're not people.
They're not people.
Yeah, they don't fucking count.
Yeah, well, they're not people now, are they? Like, if you cast midgets, like, they're little people. Now, now they're like a separate race.
Yeah, they're kind of like semi-magical beings.
Yeah, elves kind of. Yeah.
Because am I right, like, in the hi-ho sequence when they're in the mines, their hands glow for a moment?
I think so.
And they, like, loosen the rock?
Yeah.
And that's it. That's all the magic they do.
Yeah. Which, that's not a minor, really, is it? But I just think, like, I'm going to give them this much leeway. Having seven midgets
You said that. Why are you laughing?
Because look, I think it's fine, but it is the funny word, isn't it?
Okay.
Having seven midgets as the dwarves, there's something like weird about it somehow. Like I think they should have done it, but do you know what I mean? Like seven midgets, you go like, oh god, I don't know. How do I take this seriously? Almost, it's so ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? It's a weird hinterland to exist on. It does mean if you don't do that, you take away jobs from dwarves. You know.
Yeah.
But doing what they did. Yeah, making them this like other species is uncanny and weird and demeaning.
Mm.
But try and imagine the Snow White you saw with seven little people playing the dwarves. It's a strange, uncomfortable sight almost, isn't it?
I don't know.
It's got to be done well.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
It's got to be done well, but like just on the page, so to speak, in my mind, there's something not quite right about it.
Okay.
But not because it's exploitative or anything like that.
No,
just a strange image.
Yeah, I mean, she never talks down to them or anything.
No, it's nothing like that. Yeah. Nothing like that. I don't know. There's just something about it that makes me a little bit uneasy. And I can't quite articulate what that is.
Okay.
But I certainly wouldn't have then gone, oh, fuck it then. Let's do CGI dwarves.
Yeah.
I would have tried to be smart and figure out a way to do it.
Yeah.
Where I didn't feel that unease. But yeah, don't recommend it. It's, again, one of the worst films of the year.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Don't watch it.
Don't watch it. Is that it?
Yeah.
And that's it then. We will see you next time.
All right then.
Bye.
Bye-bye.